The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey everyone, welcome to Comedy History 101. This is Harmon, and today we have part one of a very special two-part episode on the history of Richard Pryor, the Black Panthers, and Berkeley, California. Yes, it's kind of the Richard Pryor origin story, where during a short period of time, he moved to Berkeley, California, and found his true comedy voice. But before we jump into the episode, quick plug, next Thursday, November 19th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I will be presenting my show Jokey-Okey, stand-up comedy karaoke in a three-round game show. You can check it out on twitch.tv/comedyhistory101. Also, if you like or even love Comedy History 101, become one of our supporters. Yes, you can support the podcast on our Patreon page, patreon.com/ch101. That's right, we want to keep the podcast completely ad-free. Yes, no ads for stamps.com or Casper mattresses. We want to be completely ad-free, so take some time and support us on Patreon. Also, check out our website, comedyhistory101.com, and leave a comment and subscribe to the podcast. And now, without further ado.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured the audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.
Richard's in the midst of all this. It's impossible to be there and not be touched by these things. He meets Huey P. Newton, head of the Black Panther Party. Richard talks about reading the autobiography of Malcolm X and how much that influenced him.
You couldn't separate Richard from the times.
I think what Richard experienced was in some ways akin to like a spiritual conversion.
Yes, what you heard there was a clip from a PBS series on Richard Pryor talking about his time living in Berkeley, California, in which he found his voice. And yes, you've tuned into another episode of
Comedy History 101,
where we school you in comedy. I am Harmon Leon. With me is, yes, Scott Colonico. Scott, when you think of Berkeley in the late 60s, early 70s, what comes to mind?
Power to the people, Harmon. Right on.
What was going on? What was going on in the Berkeley in the late 60s? Was it pretty peaceful? No turmoil?
No, people were fighting the man, Harmon. The establishment. And my dad was going to college. And that too.
There. In Berkeley?
Yeah, he went to Berkeley.
Oh, what was he out there with his shoulder length hair, toting a sign, no war?
No. This was like right before all this started. Right before all this went down.
Oh wow, that's yeah. Interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah, there you go.
But if he were there between the years of 1969 and 1971, he might have ran into a Richard Pryor on University Avenue in Berkeley, because that is where Richard Pryor landed after kind of a pretty successful career as a mainstream comedian, but landed there and actually found his true comedy voice. Hanging out with the intellectuals of the day, hanging out with the Black Panthers, hanging out with the counterculture movement. And Scott, we have talked about the Richard Pryor in the past here on the Comedy History 101.
Pryor's Place.
That's what. Yeah, tell us just once again. That was a mid '80s Carnation? Tell us what Pryor Place was. So
that was Richard Pryor's TV show that was done by Sid and Marty Croft. Producers of the 1970s crazy puppet shows. But yeah, it was kind of his version of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, and that. And we also talked about Richard Pryor in our history of Laugh Records because, again, the era of Richard Pryor, which we're going to focus on today, Laugh Records, his career launched right after that. And it was really because of his time in Berkeley that he found his voice and became the Richard Pryor, which is known in comedy legend history.
Agreed.
Here, here, says Scott. So let's go a little farther back and just like we'll briefly touch on the career of Richard Pryor. How did Richard Pryor start in comedy?
Well, Harmon, he started back. He started actually because he grew up in Peoria. He started doing comedy out around the Illinois area, kind of just in small clubs, and he eventually went on to the Chitlin circuit, as it was known back in the day. But after he'd like cut his chops for a while, he eventually moved up to New York City around 1963, and that's where he started performing in the big clubs, or the big small clubs, I guess you would say, alongside people like Bob Dylan, Woody Allen, George Carlin, Letty Bruce, and many more, and Nina Simone.
Yeah, Nina Simone, he actually opened for her, and she recalls he was so nervous, had such performance anxiety that his hand shook like he had malaria, according to her. And mm-hmm. she said, I couldn't bear to watch him shiver, so I put my arm around him in the dark and rocked him like a baby until he calmed down. The next night was the same, and the next, I rocked him each time, said Nina Simone.
Yeah, that was nice of her.
What would you say Richard Pryor's comedy was like at the time? I mean, now we know him, you know, such great characters as Mudbone. You know, the town wino and kind of just hold no bar Richard Pryor. But what was mm-hmm. his comedy like and who was he inspired by?
It was pretty mainstream. He did, because he was appearing on places like on the Merv Griffin Show and Tonight Show and Ed Sullivan. He was on those types of shows. And he did, like, he loved the physical comedy of Sid Caesar and Jerry Lewis. And his acted, you can find these on YouTube, or you can go over to our webpage at comedyhistory101.com. You can see some clips of early Richard Pryor we'll put up there. It was all kind of like he was talking about how to... the one clip I saw is talking about how to deal with bad breath and how to light cigarettes for ladies across the room. Just kind of, you know, standard kind of 60s humor.
When I get self-conscious, there's a voice in the back of my head says, how's your breath? You know, right? I get crazy, you know, because there's nothing worse than walking up to a lady saying, hi. And she says, no. And then right away you want to do something. You try to check yourselves out. You can tell when guys are worried. You ever see a guy, hi, Fred, how you doing? And guys try to be cool when they go, you know, you ever see guys this? You know.
Yeah, so, and again, this always seems really creepy to say in modern context. He was very inspired by Bill Cosby. Ugh. In comedy, just comedy-wise, he was inspired by Bill Cosby. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty funny. It was very physical, you know, but there was really nothing, you know, outstanding about it other than, you know, great physical comedian. And like you just mentioned, Scott, he was on Ed Sullivan, which was the biggest show of the time, and Merv Griffin, I guess... Was Merv huge in the 60s?
Merv Griffin was pretty big. Yeah, of course. He was really big. Yeah, then he did game shows.
That's right. Didn't he create Wheel of Fortune?
I think he did. Yep, I think so.
Merv Griffin Productions.
We'll have to do a whole episode about Pat Sajak.
I always think of, like, Merv Griffin. I always think of, like, SCTV. Like, I think it was Rick Moranis.
Oh, yeah. It would do, ooh, like, the, yeah. Ooh, yeah, ooh, yeah.
We'll be right back.
Yeah.
So what did that land him? Is, like, performing kind of, like, as a, you know, second-rung Bill Cosby-esque comedian you know, being on Ed Sullivan, being on Merv Griffin. In 1967, where did that land a 27-year-old Richard Pryor?
He was big. He was actually doing clubs in Vegas, you know, which is about as big as you could get. He was doing clubs on the Strip down there. And but at the same time, he was also doing a lot of cocaine, Harmon.
Yeah. So that, again, that was sort of a sad consistency throughout Richard Pryor's life, was just heavily into drugs up until the point
where... Like the cocaine, yes.
Yeah, he lit himself on fire while freebasing, which is which led to, ironically, to Pryor's place, which you mentioned up front.
Actually, no, the story... I think we went over the story. He didn't light himself on fire freebasing. I'm trying to remember. I can't remember the exact story, but that's the story that you tell, but it's wrong.
Oh, yeah. So there were him and a friend were... I think it was his bodyguard... We're watching a documentary on Vietnam about the Buddhist monk who lit himself on fire. Shortly after, he's starring on Pryor's place.
Yeah, there you go.
I spun the story to a happier ending.
Yeah, okay, there you go. That was good. But yeah, in 1967, when he was performing on Las Vegas, and actually at the time, some of the casinos were still segregated in Las Vegas back then, even in 1967. Pryor was out there, watched on stage before a sold-out crowd that included some members of the Rat Pack that were there in 1967. He walked out on stage, just kind of froze, blurted out, "What the fuck am I doing here?" You can bleep that out if you need to, and then walked right off stage.
Yeah, so he was at the Aladdin Hotel opening for Bobby Darin. What was his hit?
Yes. Splish splash.
Beyond the Sea. Kevin Spacey made a movie about
that's
him.
Right. Kevin Spacey did.
I mean, that's pretty much as white American as you can get, opening at a segregated casino on the Las Vegas Strip, opening for Mr. Splish Splash. The audience is all white people. The Rat Pack's in attendance, and Richard Pryor already abusing a lot of cocaine, described at the time having a walking nervous breakdown when he took to the stage and just looked out at this white crowd. He believed like the comedy that he was doing at the time was just, you know, kind of just to appease, you know, the white audience. And yeah, he just walked off and was told he would never work again. And
never work in this town again.
Never work in this town. The club gigs dried up. And also, as mentioned, with the drying up the club gigs, he was also doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah, a lot of cocaine. Cocaine's a hell of a drug, as Rick James would say.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast, called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So what happened like the year afterwards? You mentioned here in 1968, Wild in the Streets.
So this is a weird time for Pryor because he's kind of like he's visiting Berkeley, and I don't think he hasn't moved yet, but he's like kind of becoming aware, and he's just becoming more politically aware. I guess he must be making trips up there because he hasn't moved up there yet. So he's living this weird double life of going to Berkeley, just like becoming more politically aware, and then at the same time still trying to do, still doing major kind of TV bit parts and everything. Like he's in this film called Wild in the Streets that comes out in 1968, where he plays Stanley X, which is an odd kind of call nod to his Black Panther friends.
Oh, Malcolm X.
And and that was about a president who becomes 25, and a president who's 25 years old, and the kids run the country, and basically they make everybody take LSD. So it's one of those weird 60s movies.
Is that a good movie, or is it one of
Yeah, it's awesome. It's one of those weird 60s movies.
Wow, Wild in the Streets. I think I want to check that out.
Oh, yeah, check it out, definitely. And he plays the drummer.
Who did it star?
I can't remember the dude. No, but like, what's her name? Shelley Winters is in it. And she plays somebody's mom. She goes on an LSD trip. Hal Holbrook is in it. Richard Pryor plays the drummer. So the reason the guy becomes president, because he's in a big rock and roll band. So he's like the first rock and roll president. And then Richard Pryor is his drummer. So that that movie was actually filmed in 67, that came out in 68. So, you know, that's like kind of about the same time when all this other stuff is going on. So it's kind of interesting to see.
Oh, man, that's okay. I know this is one of our catchphrases. That seems like that's a whole other episode. But there's that whole genre of 60s movies, like Peter Sellers' Thank You, Alice B. Toklas.
Oh, yeah, dude. The wacky 60s movies. I mean, that one, the one with the party, although it's very impolitically correct now because Peter Sellers plays the Indian guy.
No, but in Alice B. Toklas, said the premise of that, he's like a square... I think advertising.
He's a lawyer. A lawyer.
Who accidentally drops acid and all things change. So kind of like Wild in the Streets seems like.
That one's great. Directed by Paul Mazursky. And I remember after he turns, after they turn Mondo, after he gets turned onto LSD, they're going to go see a movie called Mondo Teeth. It's a film about teeth, where they just film teeth.
Ah, okay. Which is a nod to Andy Warhol Sleep.
Yeah, probably. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm putting Wild in the Streets on my weekend playlist. So I think,
Definitely.
And we get Richard Pryor playing a drummer. So yeah, so already he's sort of counterculture, and already he's taken trips up to Berkeley, which I think was one of the reasons why in February 1971 he moved to Berkeley, because I believe he already had kind of a counterculture, you know, following, even though he was, you know, known as, well, okay, this was 2 years after, you know.
Yeah, it's weird because you can't really, they don't really, so all they have is the, how do you say that, apocryphal, this is the famous story about how he moved, is that, Pryor didn't move until February of 1971. He was at his Sunset Towers high rise, you know, down on Sunset Strip in L.A., and a quake hit. It was a 6.6 kind on the 6.6 on the Richter scale, and this quake hit, and he woke up and put on grabbed a bottle of whiskey and a samurai sword, and apparently he must put on a robe or something, and he just started walking up and down the Sunset Strip, and he said, it was time for him to go. So that's when he said, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah, or in his words, I'm ready to leave the Valley of the Damned.
Yeah. So, and he actually got a ride. So it's weird. It's some sources say Paul Mooney, but then I was reading it was in that his friend Alan Farley.
Yeah. And he's a really interesting character. Tell us a little bit about Alan Farley.
He was a radio employee of the station KPFA up there in Berkeley.
Yeah. And also, so KPFA, he's a familiar with it. It's like the student radio station. That's still going to this day.
Really? Okay, cool. Yeah, we listened to some stuff on there. I lived at a small house at 1505 Berkeley Way. And so he was a mathematician turned radio producer. He had a degree from Caltech. He came from chairing the math department at Morehouse, which is a historically Black college in Atlanta. And he had a bunch of recording equipment, and he had a show on KPFA. So that was pretty handy for Pryor.
Yeah. So again, Alan Farley had a huge influence on Richard Pryor's comedy because, again, like you said, he had a show at KPFA, and he would let Pryor come in and, you know, just record segments. Like they did a parody, a satire of the Attica. I don't even know if satire is the word, but they did a show about the Attica uprising where they would do a collage of audio clips, you know, kind of just, you know, similar to what you see in your current, mouthing Trump type videos that right. we've talked about
TikTok.
Before.
TikTok.
But, they were very experimental, very 60s.
Uprising.
How, Mr. Oswald, would you handle a situation if there were an Attica tomorrow?
I don't know. I really, truly don't know. It would be easy.
You know, very playing the media. And, you know, Pryor would always come on Alan's show because he had, you know, tons of recording equipment at home at his Berkeley house. And, you know, they became roommates. And I read Alan Farley's obituary in the SF Gate, which you think, you know, that's the San Francisco paper. And, you know, Alan Farley is a Berkeley guy, that they would go into his relationship with Pryor. But all it said was he did a stint for a while as Richard Pryor's road manager. That's pretty much all they said on his Richard Pryor connection. But he was so much more than that.
Yeah, it's odd. He's kind of one of those weird people, kind of not weird people, but it's one of those weird connections lost to history. There's not really any inkling or how they actually became friends in the first place, and how basically the way Farley convinced Pryor to move to Berkeley is because Farley had an extra couch. Actually, Farley slept on the couch, and I guess he gave
the bed to Richard Pryor. No. How they connected was after a show in L.A. You'll appreciate this, Scott. He bonded with Richard over their admiration for what type of humor?
Edgy
humor. Okay. Yeah. And their commitment to alternative media. So again, Richard, you know, had a big following in Berkeley after, you know, his club gigs dried up, and just knew, you know, that was one of the places where he could still perform in, like, San Francisco and Berkeley. So he moved into Alan Farley's apartment in Berkeley.
Fair enough. Okay.
And that was the beginning of what was described as Pryor's wilderness period, where he had gone underground.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, not only the radio show, but Pryor and Farley collaborated on a screenplay of a short anti-war film that never got produced, but ended up being published in the satirical magazine The Realist, which was published by Paul Krasner. Do you know anything about Paul Krasner?
I've heard of The Realist. I know it was a big influential magazine out there in Berkeley, but other than me saying that, I don't know.
He was one of the yippies along with Abby Hoffman. We have talked about a couple episodes ago on the new Aaron Sorkin movie, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, which
it was good.
So who did he meet in while he was in Berkeley that really influenced his comedy?
Oh, Harmon, it's more like who didn't he meet back then? See, the Black, let's go into a little bit of history there. The Black Panthers were formed in Berkeley, in Oakland, in the East Bay, back in 1966 by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, partly in response to police brutality. They were about political protests, but they were also about community service. They ran this hugely successful breakfast program that served thousands of Oakland's disadvantaged children. Actually, that program got so big, I think it started to scare the state government after a while.
Yeah, and there's another thing about, because we did a video a while back on the Black Panthers. California used to be like an open carry, state. And so the Black Panthers went, okay, you're an open carry state. We're going to open carry guns and patrol our neighborhoods because we believe, and not only believe, but we have seen it happen, that there is a lot of police brutality amongst our community. So we are just going to, they were kind of like the YouTube of the time to make sure that the police weren't, you know, beating people up, which to this day, sadly, they still are. But at the time, the Black Panthers were patrolling the neighborhood, just trying to keep the police in check.
Yeah, and then they had the that whole famous thing where they actually went to the, because you could legally carry weapons in California at the time. They marched on the state capitol in Sacramento carrying shotguns.
And who was the governor at the time?
Oh, a gentleman by the name of Ronald Reagan.
Well. That's my Reagan.
That's good, dude.
Yeah, so again, they actually, that was like a first where they actually repealed NRA rights.
Yeah, they said, okay, that was a little too much rights. While I was up there in Berkeley, Pryor met with such Black Panther Party leaders such as Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale, Angela Davis, and then some writers and the literati such as Cecil Brown, Ishmael Reed, Claude Brown, Al Young, Eldridge Cleaver.
Yeah, what was his book again? It's like something in ice or something like that. Eldridge Cleaver.
Oh yeah, something about ice, yeah, something like that. Hold on. But not iced tea.
No, and not Iceberg Slim.
No,
the story of my life. Do you ever read that book? Man.
Pimp. Oh yeah, man. Pimp.
Oh, Soul on Ice.
Yeah, Soul on Ice. Yeah.
And again, just another tie to the trial of Chicago 7, that also focused on Bobby Seale being arrested in Chicago, which he had no connection to. The riots that were instigated by the police. So he plays like a big role in that movie. But he, like Richard Pryor said, like, you know, meeting, you know, Black Panthers, you know, Huey Newton, Angela Davis, Bobby Seale was part that gave him the confidence to work in front of a microphone and talking about, you know, topics that matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not just bad breath and lighting cigarettes across the room.
Those are funny bits, though. I mean, again, it funny. Just as a piece of comedy history.
Yeah.
But it didn't give Richard Pryor the voice that became the legendary Richard Pryor. And Richard Pryor, you know, as mentioned in the clip up front, he admired the honesty of Malcolm X, you know, to address a crowd and give his feelings of what it's like to be black in America, which, again, you know, transferred to what he started doing on stage.
It's a bitch when you have learned how to act to police when you get arrested. I always get, because I'm a coward anyway, so I take the time route. Get very timey when the police come. Hi, Mr. Officer, can I help you search myself? I don't have anything on me, but be glad to go downtown and wait for you. I never could talk back to the police. It scared the shit out of me. I couldn't take them hits upside the head. Some dudes could handle that shit, you know, police. Pimp! Motherfucker! Yeah, ping! Yeah, motherfucker! You know, I never could handle that. Motherfucker, draw back at me.
Yeah, so he got down to brass tacks. He got back down to the bare minimum. So Pryor set himself up in $110 a month. That still seems kind of expensive for even back then.
Yeah, I was trying to do that. I was trying to, like, okay, that's kind of expensive because, yeah.
I know. We'll go into, I'll figure it out while you go on. So $110.
Maybe it's $110 in today's money. And then in the calculator, it was just like $30.
He furnished his apartment with little else than a bare mattress, portable TV, record player, a few books, a typewriter, and a tape recorder. He was there to focus on his craft, Harmon. I'll find out how much $110 is worth. You keep going.
Yeah, and one of his friends at the time was Cecil Brown, who also later wrote a book about Richard Pryor. He was teaching English at Berkeley, and he said that Richard realized that he had another culture that was deeply embedded in the black tradition of storytelling. At the time, Cecil Brown was teaching, you know, such authors as Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes, and Cecil Brown said, and so I would tell him, Richard, man, you know, the stuff you're doing is what black people have been doing like the poets for generations.
I agree. I'm figuring out my $110. Yeah, so it's saying $110 in 1971 would be worth $700 today in 2020.
Okay, then that's just, you know.
So it was a pretty old, it was bare minimum of his apartment.
Yeah. And now those apartments in Berkeley just go boom through the roof.
Yeah. Yeah, we won't even talk about it. Now he could rent his closet out for $110 a month.
Yeah. But the apartment and his minimalist kind of Buddhist furnishings kind of reflected his intense focus on his craft. And we'll get into Richard Pryor's first gigs in Berkeley in our next episode, which will wrap up nicely with a tight bow about basically the Richard Pryor origin story. And with that, it's time to plug away. Scott, what do you have to plug?
Well, Harmon, as our listeners probably know from me plugging this all the time, I have another podcast and a YouTube channel called This is a President, where I go into all things presidential. We just put up an episode, Harmon, about Gerald Ford and the swine flu. It's actually pretty interesting, the parallels going on back in this. Do you remember the swine flu epidemic of 1976, Harmon?
Well, I have a question. First of all, did Gerald Ford, when there was a swine flu, did he of the day complain about what the equivalent of Fox News's ratings are, rather than focus on the swine flu?
No, I think
because we currently got a guy doing that.
Yeah. It's actually kind of a crazy story. You go over to the YouTube channel, this is youtube.com/thisisthepresident, see all that. We also have a podcast with that, and Harmon sometimes is my guest on that as well. And you can find that wherever you find your favorite podcasts, such as Apple iTunes, Stitcher, and Last FM as well, Spotify as well. So that's it. Yeah, This is the President. Go by, stop by, subscribe, drop us a line, comment. Thank you.
Yeah, and for me, next Thursday, November 19th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I'll be doing my show Jokey Okey, stand-up comedy karaoke in a 3-round game show. You can check it out on our Twitch channel, which is twitch.tv/comedyhistory101. All I can say about the show is America loves Jokey Okey. And as always, take some time to like, subscribe, and comment on Comedy History 101, wherever you get your podcasts, be it Stitcher or Spotify or Apple or whatnot, or on our site, comedyhistory101.com. Also, friends, if you like or even love Comedy History 101, become one of our supporters. Yes, we try to make this podcast ad-free, but we need your support. So please support us on patreon.com/CH101 for the cost of a cup of coffee. If we get all our 100,000 listeners just to donate $1 a month, we will keep our podcast ad-free. Because, Scott, do the people want to hear about stamps.com in the middle of their podcast?
No, they don't, Harmon. And they don't want to hear about beds or Casper mattresses. And the thing is, Harmon, they could give more than $1 if they wanted to. They don't have to. They could give us $1. But if they wanted to give $5 or $10 even a month, it just comes out automatically of your account. It's just like paying us, and you get all sorts of incredible extras yet to be determined.
So just to tease that, we have an upcoming extra on a political podcast, which is a spinoff of the podcast This is the President, and that will be a feature upcoming for subscribers only.
Only.
And with that, thanks a lot for tuning in, and we'll see you next time, and bye-bye.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.